Come take me home, come take me home, come take me home again. Someday it's going to come, come take me home again. Come on, it's a train.
Good morning. It's 8:07. You're listening to KBOO. This is Positively Revolting. My name is Lynn Molik. That was Yusuf Islam with his second rendition of Peace Train that he had to kind of redo it for the beginning of the Iraq War, if you can remember how long ago that was. It was, I believe, 2003 that began. Anyway, this morning, I am honored to have two of the busiest, hardest working folks for peace that I know of anyway on the show today. First, we have Dan Handelman of Peace and Justice Works and Cop Watch here in Portland. What else are you doing these days?
Oh, I'm also with a group called Flying Focus Video Collective, but that's not important right now.
Okay, well, good. Well, I want to know all these things. And we are also very honored to have Nobel Peace nominated Kathy Kelly, who coordinates Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a U.S. campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. She has traveled to Afghanistan three times in 2010 with a small delegation's intent on learning more about conditions faced by ordinary folks in Afghanistan, a country, as we know, afflicted by three decades of warfare. Voices for Creative Nonviolence has been working closely with the Afghan youth peace volunteers in search of non-military solutions to end war. In 2009, she lived in Gaza during the Operation Cast Lead bombing. Later that year, Voices formed another small delegation to visit Pakistan. She's busy, I'm telling you. this is going to go on, aiming to learn more about the effects of U.S. drone warfare on the civilian population and to better understand consequences of U.S. foreign policy in Pakistan. From 1996 to 2003, Voices activists formed 70 delegations that openly defied economic sanctions by bringing medicines to children and families. You rebels, you, in Iraq. Kathy and her companions lived in Baghdad throughout the 2003 shock and awe. Remember that, folks? Bombing. She was sentenced to 1 year in federal prison for planting corn on nuclear mission silo sites in 1988-89 and spent 3 months in prison in 2004 for crossing the line at Fort Benning's Military Training School. I believe she's been on the last two flotillas going to Gaza. We're going to talk about that. And she, I love this, she and her companions at Voices for Creative Nonviolence in the Home Office in Chicago believe that nonviolence necessarily involves simplicity, service, sharing, and resources, sharing of resources, and nonviolent direct action in resistance to war and oppression. Good morning, Kathy Kelly.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having us on your show.
Oh, I am so happy to do that. So you were on the last Freedom Flotilla, were you not?
That's right. And actually, we have a team in Afghanistan right now. We just talked with them over the phone, and I was there myself with 27 people in 2011 in March. So it has been a busy stretch, but that's, of course, because the United States warfare is constant and growing and menacing.
It is, indeed. How do you feel about what's going on in Libya?
Well, I believe that it's wrongful for the United States to be involving itself in aerial attacks against Libyans. I think that we should never, ever support dictators or in any way try to uphold their abilities to wage war against their own people, but I don't think that the United States should be involved in this warfare. And I think that for NATO, you know, my hope is that when they gather here in Chicago, my city, in May of 2012, that there will be many, many thousands of people who will come to that summit when also the G8 figures will be meeting and say, enough is enough, you know, throw a retirement party for NATO, that we don't any longer want to keep thinking that the only way to solve problems is to keep throwing bombs and weapon systems at other countries or putting them in the hands of people who will join the United States in celebrating mass murder.
Yeah, this whole policing the world doesn't seem to be working for us.
No, I don't think so.
And certainly not for the rest of the world.
Yeah, if we could recognize that security is not only defined by your ability to gain one-upmanship in terms of weapons and ability to kill and murder and destroy homes. Security involves people having food security and reducing unemployment rates and being able to deliver health care and clean water. And these are things that the world could be providing, but instead our constant warfare keeps on sort of like a vacuum cleaner almost, sucking up the wealth and the productivity of countries that have any wealth and then horribly forcing poorer countries into pushing toward combat and more killing and destruction.
And it doesn't seem to be doing much for our economy.
Well, it is amazing to me that we don't see connections being made in the mainstream media between the expenditures that go toward building up the United States' extremely, extended military bases and the ways in which so much money goes into the Defense Department. Linda Bilnes has done an outstanding job again in showing just how much money is going to be spent ultimately on the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and this at a time when people are seriously worrying for being able to care for the elderly in their communities and their own families, and when our education systems are flailing. It's extraordinary to me that we don't see more analysis that would prod people to ask questions. Why? What security are we gaining from pouring so much money? I mean, it's $2 billion per week being spent on the war in Afghanistan, $10 billion per month. And then you can see studies that show how portions of that spending are every day poured into the pockets of racketeers who run protection outfits so that the trucks that go along the roads to deliver supplies to all these many thousands of U.S. Military and security contractors have to pay money into the hands of either criminal gangsters or sometimes the Taliban themselves.
Wow. If you have questions for Kathy Kelly, I forgot to tell you this in the beginning. We have a phone number here, and it is called 503-231-8187. You can also contact us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com if you don't want to talk. Get your questions in early or rather than later, because the phone lines tend to back up towards the end. And Kathy, you're going to be in town. We're really happy about that. Friday, August 5th at 7, speaking at the Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at Portland Community College in the Cascade Campus, which is 705 North Killingsworth at Albina. That's going to be really good. And you're going to be talking about the cost of war and the price of peace. So what would the price of peace be, do you think?
Well, I think part of the price of peace, and it may sound odd, but it involves all of us slowing down and taking time to think about where our resources are going and whether or not we want to continue waging the wars that we're waging and who benefits. So that's part of the price of peace. And then it also means, I believe, that we would have to ask ourselves, okay, what's a fair price to pay for the resources that we want to be able to take from other countries? And if it's a price that is higher than we want to pay, then maybe we have to learn how to cut back and to, you know, not be so overly consumptive of the energy resources, for instance, that the United States is so invested in. And I think we also have to recognize that in many ways the United States is in a cold war with China. Nobody likes to say that, I suppose, because we're also so economically interdependent with China. But when we ask ourselves, why is the United States spending such enormous amounts of wealth and productivity in Afghanistan, it seems that it has to do with the United States wanting to control the energy resources that come from the Caspian Sea and would ultimately be transported through countries like Afghanistan, so that China won't have access to those resources, like natural gas and fossil fuels, at a price that's less than what the United States has to pay, for instance, and then China would have an economic advantage. And so the United States very much wants to be able to secure the construction of a pipeline called the TAPI pipeline, the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline. And also geopolitically, the United States wants to be situated militarily with strong bases in an area that's very close to Russia, Iran, China, and Pakistan, Pakistan being the one country in the Arab world, the Muslim world, that has the nuclear bomb. Well, I think the price of peace would mean that we'd have to rethink our role within the world and say that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be the ones that are controlling the pricing and the flow of precious and irreplaceable resources, that this is not something that's a God-given inherent right of people in the United States or elites within the United States military and State Department and foreign policy makers. And this, of course, involves people paying attention and maybe paying more attention to these issues than they pay to entertainment and sports issues. That's part of the price of peace, that people really care about their children. They're not going to be so invested in sports and entertainment and arranging sports and entertainment for their children that they aren't able to look at the very issues that will directly affect the futures of their children, who will inherit the debts for our overextended bloated military budgets, and also our failure to address the real terrors that are facing us. And by that I mean the terrors caused by what we're doing to our own environment, our overconsumption of fossil fuels, our pollution of our air and of our water, the effects of climate change. These are the problems our scientists should be addressing, not trying to figure out how to develop better drone weaponry so that we can have automated and robotized means to attack other people's lands and children and families and homes.
Like it's a game.
Mm.
I mean, people sit in a box in Colorado somewhere, isn't it? I don't know where it is. What do you do? All those things are so true. And how do you address people's sort of awareness fatigue? There are so many things coming down on people's heads right now. How do we keep in hope and energized about this?
Well, you know, I don't want to be shrill or overly judgmental, but when I think about awareness fatigue, I'm not actually feeling too sympathetic toward many people who, compared to people in other parts of the world, are living not only quite comfortably. I mean, you know, we have electricity without any question unless there's a terrible storm. We generally have capacity for transportation, and we're able to put in our refrigerators enough food to feed our families, and you know, when we want some kind of health care, we're usually able to get access to it. So that's what I mean in some of the descriptions of comfort. But we also have at our fingertips instant awareness available. Many of us in our own homes, because we have computers and internet, and we can stay on top of things. Now, the reason I'm not too sympathetic with the idea of fatigue and awareness fatigue is that I do sense that people have tremendous awareness of what is happening with Hollywood celebrities. You could have asked many people across this country about Kate Middleton's wedding dress, and their awareness would have been sharp and precise. People have awareness about issues related to football and basketball and baseball and their children's soccer games and the schedule for play dates that are arranged for the children and many, many things that I would kind of put in the category of sports and entertainment. So I'm just kind of trying to balance it a bit. I suppose people try to balance the budget. I'd like to say let's take some of that awareness out of the sports and entertainment, the bread and circuses, and just start shouldering the responsibilities of an adult in this country and put some of the awareness on the robbers, the people that are pickpocketing the U.S. public, taking their hard-earned resources and throwing it into ever-increasing defense spending that doesn't defend their own interests. And then to be able to sit up straight, and instead of wondering, you know, what are they going to say to the coach in their kids' soccer team games, or what are they going to, you know, say when they're talking back to the television, go right to the elected leader's office and say, we have something to say to you. And in fact, MoveOn.org, not necessarily a radical organization by any stretch, is organizing exactly those kinds of meetings all across the country today. And I wish them success. And I think people can also start to speak up to their own close-at-hand community leaders. And I've seen a lot of that in Portland, actually. It's a smaller city, and you do see people standing up. And I know Dan can speak to that much more because he's been very invested in local politics, including Cup Watch and other kinds of things. But people can say to the universities, how about helping young people learn more about the world that they're going to be entering into, and what kind of curriculum are you offering that will help people understand how to adjust given the realities of climate change and changes in food production? You know, they can say to their local media, we want more talk shows and panels and informational kinds of programming that have to do with climate change or with food production or with the defense expenditures, and really insist we want to be an educated public.
Well, and at KABU, we try to do that, and yes, people need, we are a community radio station that gives that sort of information all the time. So supporting KABU is one way for folks to keep informed. And Dan, did you have something you wanted to?
Oh, well, I just want to say hi to Kathy.
Hi, Dan.
Haven't had a chance yet. Sorry.
We've worked together for a long time now. And I want to remind everybody that Kathy will be in town not only for the event that Lynn's talking about, that Peace and Justice Works is coordinating next Friday night, August 5 at 7 o'clock. And I just noticed there's a typo on the flyer about the address. So I'll fix that on our website, which is www.pjw.info. But Kathy will also be at the Veterans for Peace National Convention that's happening here in Portland from August 3 to 7. And I've gotten mixed information about Kathy, about whether your keynote speech is going to be open to the public or not. But I know there are public events that people can participate in, particularly next Thursday, the 4th. And Kathy and the veterans will be joining Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and us and other groups on Sunday, August 7. For the Hiroshima Day annual memorial event that'll be happening from 1 to 4 p.m. Down at the Japanese American Historical Plaza down at Waterfront Park. So there's lots of opportunities to see and hear Kathy and get involved in things in this coming week.
Indeed. We'll put all this information, the show will be up online I'm sure by tomorrow. Our lovely Alicia that puts it online for us, thank you very much. And we'll have links to those things. And I believe we've got a caller on the line. Jack?
Yeah, that's me.
Hi. Have you got a question or a comment for Kelly?
Well, I want to say that Kathy and Dan, they're doing the most important work. These wars are at the heart of everything that's wrong. And we really got to be focused on ending them, and not distracted by the numerous wedge issues that are thrown at us. People ranting about idiots like Glenn Beck. I mean, what a distraction! You know, these wars are the most horrible thing going on. And you know, all of the phony stuff that's thrown up to frighten people into supporting them and buying into the whole protection game and so forth, and the worst of it all is it almost looks like, and of course, if you say this, you're labeled a conspiracy theorist right away. It almost looks like there is a systematic population reduction program going on. The depleted uranium munitions are spreading death for ages to come. Who knows how long that will last? And you can see very clearly. And I'd like Kathy to address this because she's been there so much, and she probably has seen so much of this. Use of these kind of munitions that are designed to pierce and destroy armored vehicles, and using them against populations that have no such armored vehicles to fight with, And why would you use this kind of thing if it's not just to poison the environment and to kill people for who knows how long? Essentially, it looks like getting people out of the way of keeping them between the financiers and their resources. And I'd like you to address that. Thanks so much, and thanks so much for your work, Dan, especially here with Veterans for Peace, and Kathy on your tour. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. You know, the ways in which civilians have borne the brunt of war, I think, are almost incalculable. Jack has mentioned the poisons that happen because of the usage of depleted uranium, it's very, very difficult to calculate the effects of these weapons, and it may be that it will be, you know, generations before before human beings could really measure how much destruction of the environment and how much disease has been caused by the kinds of weapons that the United States is using and that we're selling and shipping to other countries and storing for future use. It's a horrible, ugly scar on the history of this country, but it's also going to create horrors for many generations. In Iraq, this is anecdotal, really, but I'm always mindful of a time when I went to a hospital in Baghdad, and it was a small little hospital, an obstetrics and gynecological hospital run by two women. And, Baghdad was completely cut off in the late 90s, the early years of the decade of the 2000 years from outside communication. And these women, they really didn't have a whole lot of savvy about what was happening to cause so much congenital disease and malformation amongst the babies that they were delivering in the hospital. And I asked them, along with a photographer, could we visit, the ward of new infants? And the photographer was really pretty aggressive. She wanted to take some pictures to accompany an article that a British journalist was writing. And so these two women said, well, yes, you can come with us. And we were just appalled. We were seeing baby after baby who had very severe congenital malformations. And so the photographer started asking these two doctors question after question, sociological kinds of demographics. Do you know where were the mothers when they conceived? Do you know where the fathers were during the 1991 Gulf War? Do you know anything about the circumstances environmentally that might have affected these children beginning stages of life? And the women just kind of looked at us almost like deers caught in headlights. And finally, one of the women doctors took my hand and she said, please come with me and let me show you something. And what she showed me was a prescription that had been attached to an IV pole for one of the patients. And it was written in pencil on a scrap of paper. She said, we don't even have pencils and pens and paper here. We don't have the means to do the kind of research that you're questioning about. This is well beyond us. And so, we were attacking one of the countries in the world that had become among the poorest, and they were coping with 500,000 of their children under age 5 dying, and those deaths directly caused by the economic sanctions that Dan and others in Portland and certainly Voices and people across this country worked hard to eliminate, to end. We challenged them, we defied them as best we could. But those people that we were speaking with in Iraq were bearing the brunt. And they had, I know we don't want to struggle hot, but if I could just an update to now in Afghanistan when we traveled there. I sat down with some young women who are part of families that engage in potato farming. They never have enough. They never have enough food. They hardly ever get electricity. They never have easy reliance on fuel or clean water. And I asked these young women, did you ever hear about a time when U.S. Buildings were hit by people who had hijacked passenger airplanes? And they looked at me like I was maybe a little crazy. What was I talking about? They'd never heard of 9/11. And the point I want to make is people who meant us no harm are bearing the brunt of our wars in their very bodies because of the pollution and because of the poisons that our warfare visited upon their land. That's not even beginning to look at the landmines that have been scattered, the cluster bombs that have been scattered. I remember being in southern Lebanon during the 2006 war, and the war had ended, and we were going out along roadways, and we skidded to a stop because there was a cluster bomb right in front of us. And then I was trying to empty out broken glass from the kitchen we were staying in, and fortunately, somebody said, "Don't empty it into the garden. My mother's a gardener." And the next morning, somebody knocked on the door. It might have been a Hezbollah figure, I don't know. And he said, "I just want to show you something in this garden." And they had already tracked down that there was a cluster bomb right there in the garden. Well, the cluster bombs were dumped all over the olive tree orchards, the children's play lots, the roadways. Who made all those cluster bombs? Quite likely, they came from the Alliant Tech factory in Edina, Minnesota. That factory had flown the flag of Israel over their buildings because they were so pleased that they'd gotten a contract earlier. And in that particular war, Condoleezza Rice had sent word to the Israelis, "Don't begin a ceasefire. We can still rush a bunker buster or two to you from Raytheon. We can get more weapons to you, so don't sign a ceasefire yet. We've got more weapons available for you." Well, this is the consequence that we have to try to understand, that other people in other parts of the world start to hate us. They're angry. They feel trapped. They feel as though they can't possibly protect their children, in some cases feed their children, and then they're up against the most intimidating, menacing arsenal in the world, that of the United States, and then those to whom we sell our weapons, and then we have to think about Israel and Saudi Arabia and Colombia. And so the United States becomes a country that is less secure because there are so many people who could nod with approval if an attack was made against us.
Yes, that is all true. Excuse me. it is so big. And yet so simple, don't you think, to stop this?
Well, I mean, I can tell you one thing I've done, which very, very few people can do. I realize, in a sense, I'm sort of privileged. I've successfully resisted all forms of federal income tax since 1980. And, as a young teacher, I've realized I can't do it. I can't be telling my classes about the nuclear arms race, about the dangers of nuclear weapon proliferation, about the ways in which we're, in a sense, robbing people who have needs. We could solve world hunger. We could solve many diseases that afflict populations around the world. But instead, we're building up these trillion-dollar nuclear weapon systems. And I thought, that's it. I can't pay for it any longer. So I became a war tax refuser, and I sometimes joke and say the IRS has been my spiritual director, but okay, so you can't own anything, or the IRS will surely come and take it, and you can't have, for instance, a tenured professional job because you have to be able to pick up and leave if they come to garnish your wages. But those are small prices to pay, and trying to stay underneath the taxable income is a small price to pay in order to be able to stay out of something as repugnant and horrific as the United States war-making. I want nothing to do with supporting the fat cats who are war profiteers in this country. I don't want to support the mafia locally. I don't want to support the United States weapon systems or the United States military. So it's one small step. But then I think, okay, most people can't do that, but what can we do in our everyday lives that can involve us more in the effort to be part of a peace movement within the United States? Now, locally, Dan's your man to talk to. Dan Hendelman has never stopped, never. His adult life has been dedicated toward research, toward education, toward action, and toward organizing. And there are many, many more like him. But people can say, okay, that's the crew I want to be with. it is a bit like choosing sides. And if you don't want to be on the side of the fat cats who are profiteering from our horrible wars, then get on the side of the people that are organizing in the peace movement. And the circle we most need to expand is the circle of people who will do just what Dan and Peace and Justice Works have been doing, arrange education and outreach events, make the press releases, make the flyers, send out the email alerts and updates. These are things people know how to do, and we need those skills. So if there are listeners who are hearing right now and thinking, well, maybe I could get more involved, I want to be a cheerleader for that.
That's great, Kathy. Actually, that's one of the things I wanted to do this morning is say, you know, your appearance isn't until a week from now, so I'm hoping that we can get people to help volunteer to make phone calls and put up flyers and get the word out to get other people there. And the event next Friday at PCC Cascade is actually it's free and open to the public, and we do hope that people will show up for that. I want to make sure, too, that people know one of the things that we asked you to talk about, that you offered to talk about, is the drones, the use of drones over Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm hoping you can talk a little about that now.
Hold on 1 second. Let me idea. So people know that I am Lynn Molik here with Dan Handelman, and we are talking to Kathy Kelly this morning. And we're going to talk right now about, and we're on KBOO in Portland, and we're going to talk about drones.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, maybe the place to start is to remember that in 1945, one country had the nuclear weapon, the United States. Look at us now, with weapon proliferation all over the world and tremendous dangers always that one of these nuclear weapons would be used. Now, in recent years, the Lady Gaga of the defense industry, if you will, has been the development of unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, or colloquially, drones. And the United States has been using them for some time, but it has greatly escalated the usage of drone warfare in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. It's a kind of weapon of choice of both President Obama and former NATO commander in Afghanistan, General Petraeus. And the arguments that people use for the drone warfare are that our soldiers won't get hurt because our soldiers aren't anywhere near the war zone. And yet, in a way, when you think about where the soldiers are who are operating these drones, okay, it's the United States Air Force. The United States Air Force has graduated in two successive years now more pilots, and I'm going to put that word in quotes, pilots who never get in an airplane and, you know, in the cockpit and put on their helmet, but rather go into dimly lit trailers at places like Creech Air Force Base in Las Vegas, or in upstate New York at the Syracuse Hancock Field. And their job is if they're the person who is looking at the screen, that they're not flying the airplane, they're looking at a screen and they're tracking high-value targets. They're tracking individuals or groups of individuals in Afghanistan and Pakistan whom they think might possibly be either insurgents with the Taliban or people who might in some way attack American forces or might be giving support to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And so they watch where those individuals go. Now, the unmanned aerial vehicle might be a Predator, for instance, and this is a vehicle that can circle the skies and be equipped with two Hellfire missiles and a 500-pound bomb. Now, if the kill chain, which then becomes involved if they've kind of honed in on somebody they want to kill or some group they want to kill, if the kill chain has examined all of the information that's coming in from these drones and decided, yes, this is a target, then the person in Creech Air Force Base or at Hancock Field in Syracuse then gets the word, gets the order, and they're to pull the lever, they do impact, and then the Hellfire missiles or the 500-pound bomb hit that target and anyone else who may happen to be living with the target or driving with the target or on a roadside nearby the target. And what they've described, a CIA agent who watched this on the screen said that what you see is an implosion and then body parts scattered and people running. The military parlance for the people running away is that they are squirters. Well,
wow. Just when you think it can't get any more grotesque, okay.
Now, I want to go back to the word proliferation. Do we
Please.
Think that the United States is the only country that's going to develop this new means of warfare? Not a chance. China is working on companies in China are working to develop their weaponized drone craft, and there are at least 250 companies worldwide that are building these things. And the aim of some of the United States companies is to create effective swarms. And this would mean that smaller drones would go in a swarm all at once and be able to attack targets simultaneously. There are drones that are being developed that can go through windows and up and down staircases, and there's even work on a drone that can disobey its orders if it thinks that somehow it's being ordered to attack an aircraft that might actually be on the American side. So it sounds a bit like science fiction, I know. But a number of us had gone to Creech Air Force Base in Nevada for a vigil outside the base, holding up signs and talking about ground the drones and let's see, reap the whirlwind. And we walked onto the base with a letter for the base commander. We were arrested, and it was a long process, but after 2 years, we went to trial. It was an interesting trial because we were able to bring Ramsey Clark, Colonel Ann Wright, and Professor Bill Quigley in to give expert testimony. And unusually for all of us, the judge said, "I need 4 months to think about this." It was a bench trial, not a jury trial. And he was impressed enough by the information that he'd heard that he really felt he needed to sift through it. Now, he ultimately found us guilty, and he said that there was no imminent danger. But as Brian Terrell said, speaking up for us, a drone operator, a U.S. Air Force pilot at Creech Air Force Base, had commented that he's 7,000 miles away from the war zone, and he's 18 inches from the war zone as he sits in front of his screen. And technically, the United States, as a belligerent attacking a sovereign country, which Pakistan is, in fact, it's supposed to be one of our allies, could be viewed as a country that could be attacked by another country because we are attacking people using our technology that's existent right here within the United States.
What, Kathy, what do you think our relationship with Pakistan really is? I mean, supposed to be an ally, but that's an odd way to treat an ally, though we do tend to do that.
Well, I think that the United States was very much an ally of the Pakistan Secret Service over the years when the United States wanted to build up the Taliban so that it would attack the Soviet Union, and the United States had a close working relationship with Pakistan's military. In fact, under Pervez Musharraf, the United States gave Pakistan $11 billion, $8 billion of which went to the military. Now, if you're a Pakistani civilian and your military owns not only huge stretches of land, but also the sugar industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the textile industry, another country supporting that military is basically supporting the military's capacity to dictate what happens in Pakistan. And yet, at the same time, the United States is attacking Pakistan every single day with drone aircraft, and the Pakistani government has said no journalist can go anywhere near North or South Waziristan where these drone attacks are happening. So even people in Pakistan aren't able to find out what's happening except through word of mouth or through phone calls that are able to get out as people say, yeah, this bloody thing has happened again. I went to Pakistan with a small team, and we talked to people on two separate occasions in two different delegations who were survivors of drone attacks. And I suppose, you know, in a way it was hearsay, but, you see how civilians are completely trapped, in a sense, in one small village called Khaisur with 500 people, and no roads even leading up to the village immediately. They have to walk some considerable distance just to get to a roadway. But according to this survivor, strangers had entered the village and gone to the home of village elders and knocked on the door. Well, that was enough to make that home a target because these strangers, according to the United States, probably CIA and Langley, because it's the CIA who arranges the attacks in Pakistan, these were apparently high-value targets. So the strangers were long gone. But at 4:30 in the morning, it was determined that the home they had visited, which is a home that's obliged to give hospitality to strangers, was targeted and blown up, and three village elders were killed. Now, this kind of story is repeated again and again and again. And people in these small villages, you know, they don't have ambulance services. They don't have emergency medical technicians. They had to carry people's torn and battered bodies to a roadside and try to flag a car. But what car wants to stop? The drivers are afraid that they'll be the next ones to be hit. And this kind of warfare is considered very cowardly by people in Pakistan. I think the New York Times reports today that the approval rating toward the United States is something like 12% in all of Pakistan.
I'm surprised it's that.
Yeah, of course. People don't like to live under the onus of possibly being bombed. They say the children in the high schools can't study because in that region because they're constantly afraid if they hear a drone that they might be under attack, and parents don't want to send their children to school. And then in Afghanistan, I went to a refugee camp called Charahi Khambar, and it was clear there was pretty intense antagonism toward Westerners in general, and probably us in particular. But the people who were called the village elders, who, by the way, were half my age, the average lifespan.
I was going to say, what is the average lifespan?
Yeah, 42 years of age in Afghanistan is the average lifespan. 850 children die every single day from malnourishment, malaria, respiratory diseases. And while children are dying of hunger, our vehicles, 7,000 a month, are crossing the border and fanning out and making sure that the U.S. military bases have electricity, fuel, food, clean water. And meanwhile, in this wretched refugee camp where people were made refugees because of our war, they fled a drone bombing in their own district, the Sangin district in the Helmand province. And they fled because a United States aerial drone attack had shot right into their family compounds. Four families lived together. They were goat herders. And they were happy with their lives. They said they sold their yogurt. They fattened up their goats. They'd sell the goats and get new ones. They took their flock in various areas. But they had an area that they settled into. And for some reason, maybe a Taliban fighter had come into the area. I'm not sure, but a drone missile was fired right into their area, and one man showed me a picture of two children's bodies that were mutilated, and they were corpses, bloodied corpses, and those were two of his five children who'd been killed. His wife had also been killed, and his brother said, "We can't wait around to see if this will happen again," so they picked up and left and became refugees in Kabul. Where are they going to go? They went to a refugee camp. And this camp is a place where there are now 1,000 families living under such wretched conditions. They're burning garbage for fuel. In the winter months, they're incredibly cold, and the man kind of flicked the blanket over a plastic tarp on the mud hut that they'd constructed for themselves, and the blanket immediately ripped, and it was no protection for them. And I looked at barefoot children and imagined the snows and the winter harsh weather coming, and the man said to me, "Do you think that we like to live this way?" I said, "No, I'm sure you don't." And then I was led into the family compound further in this camp, and another mud hut, and went inside, and that was in a December visit, and it was a little cold, and so I kind of huddled next to the little girl next to me, and her uncle unzipped the top of her jacket and showed me that she'd lost her arm in that same drone attack. Well, these are real people. They're in the eyes of many in the United States, they don't even exist. You know, we don't even think about the fact that every single day we're attacking people in Pakistan and Afghanistan and hitting civilians. We don't think about the night raids and the U.S. soldiers that come up to a family home and throw a grenade in first, and in the summer months when people are sleeping outdoors, kill people just as they're asleep, as happened with 12-year-old Niloufar on May 1st. When a night raid happened. We don't think about the death squads and the assassinations and all of the many ways in which we're terrifying people in other lands while we spend $2 billion a week to maintain our warfare in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to correct something you said in a way, that we don't think about the use of drones, and yet it's become so insidious that I was just doing the New York Times crossword puzzle from July 3rd, and there was a clue that said, "Plane over Yemen, comma, maybe," and the answer was drone.
Really?
This was in the New York Times crossword puzzle.
Well, Dan, thank you. You know, I should also mention that people know enough about drones to have laughed, along with President Obama, when, and this is probably over a year ago, he was asked what he would do if any young man ever made unwanted overtures toward his two daughters, and he said, call in the drones.
Mm, something along those lines. Yeah, that was really appalling, and everybody laughed.
Yeah, so we know they exist. But I guess what I'm thinking of is the fact that you can also read in the New York Times news reports very regularly an unmanned aerial vehicle attacked a group of people in the Helmand province or in the Kandahar province or in Khalil Street. You can read about the night raids just in two lines. And it begins to seem so commonplace that it doesn't seem like news. And so people turn the page. And I found myself kind of turning the page also, and I thought, well, oh my gosh, if I'm turning the page and I
know
that from Afghanistan,
we're in trouble.
Something's the matter.
We're in trouble.
So we started what we call an Afghan atrocities update. And you sort of feel like the Grim Reaper's secretary. It's a macabre thing to do in some ways, but every day, three or four of us here in Chicago start the day by taking a look at antiwar.com and at different news sources from Afghanistan and Pakistan, and we try to make sure we identify who the unarmed civilians have been in a given week that were killed by United States night raids or aerial attacks. And we only list the unarmed civilians. And almost every week there are updates. Well, you know, in Germany, when a German commander called in a NATO strike on a group of people who had gone to a tanker that had been hijacked by the Taliban, and then the Taliban couldn't get it out of a ditch that it had sunk into. It kind of drove into a bog, I guess. The Taliban fled, but many, many people who were poor and saw fuel and thought, well, you know, why wait, gathered their young and got their canisters and started siphoning off the very valuable fuel from this abandoned vehicle. But the German military base nearby knew only from surveillance, I guess, that there was a burgeoning number of people assembling, and they wondered, are these people going to attack us? They didn't know the whole story. And so the military commander called in an airstrike, and I believe 96 civilians were killed in that airstrike, and they were people who had gone to siphon off the fuel from the abandoned vehicle or people that were standing around watching. Anyway, the reason I remember that so much, I believe it was September 21st of 2010, is that by November, that story had been in the news so much in Germany. German civilians, German journalists were so aware of it that the German defense establishment had to come into the public and give accountability. And they had some switch-arounds, and some of the people responsible were transferred out of their jobs. I mean, it isn't that they decided, okay, we're bringing all our troops back home, but at least you had the public so aware of this horrific scandal that the German government and military couldn't squelch it. They couldn't hide it under the rug, basically. Now, that's not true for the United States. Hamid Karzai has begged 14 different times that the United States stop killing civilians. And maybe I could just give you a quick chronology. On January 19th, Petraeus said publicly, we've got our teeth in their jugular, and we're not going to give up now. February 19th, a month later, General Petraeus again was confronted by Hamid Karzai and his aides, saying 66 or 67 civilians were killed in your recent air attack, and this is unacceptable. And they showed him pictures when he said, oh, no, only seven of them were civilians. So they started showing him pictures of children whose bodies were burned and scorched. And he said, oh, that's how Afghan parents sometimes discipline their children. Well, you know, this incensed, infuriated people in Afghanistan. March 1st, nine children are out collecting scrap wood on a mountainside. And a United States helicopter gunship hovered over these children, came down low. A surviving child said, we saw a flash of green light. Next thing the child knew, the helicopter gunship had soared upward and then came back down and systematically executed each of the children. And he survived because a tree fell on him. It's like the My Lai massacre. Now, General Petraeus apologized for that one. But March 15th, it happened again. Children were cleaning out an irrigation ditch. And in this case, two children were killed. On August 26th of 2010, there were six children killed on a mountainside collecting scrap metal. I mean, I can go through case after case after case.
But we are almost out of time. And I would love to have you go through case after case. Kathy, this has been incredibly informative. We're really very honored to have you on KBOO. And I want to thank you. And we're going to see you later.
Well, and at that point, sorry for the dog.
That's all right.
At that point, we'll have slides and maps, and we can think together about this. I really thank you, Lynn, for all this time, and sorry to have taken off on a discourse.
No, it was fascinating.
We want to inform ourselves and others, and we'll do our best, okay?
All right.
I do want to remind everybody, Kathy will be in town in Portland next Friday, August 5, at 7 o'clock at the Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at PCC Cascade at 705 North Killingsworth. You can get more information on our website, www.pjw.info. There are 8 co-sponsors, including KBOO. There are going to be some tables there for information so you can get involved locally, and please help us get the word out.
And Kathy will also be in Portland for the Veterans for Peace National Convention. Is that Sunday, August 7th? It's Hiroshima event day also. She'll be part of that. You'll just be busy here as usual, Kathy.
Well, so, that will be great to be with all of you in Portland. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, that about does it today for Positive Revolting. Thank you, Dan Handelman, as always.
No problem. And if people want to call our office, the number is 503-236-3065. And, you know, if you want to get involved or have
and
questions.
And Dan answers the phone.
I do often.
He actually answers the phone. It's a great thing. So thank you all. And please continue to be positively revolting.